Professor Garber will be speaking to us today on the topic of Galileo and the laws of motion. Please join me in welcoming Professor Garber.
Thank you all very much for coming, and I'd like to thank the organizers for having invited me to this lovely occasion today. The 17th century is a period in which nature came to be understood through mathematics. Let's see if I can figure out. Yep, this works. In his essay, Galileo famously wrote, "Philosophy is written in this grand book, the universe, which stands continually open to our gaze. But the book cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language and read the letters of which it is composed. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one wanders about in a dark labyrinth." And this, in a way, I think can be understood as a motto for the century as a whole, or at least for those figures in the century who are now recognized as the ancestors of modern science. And Galileo was very much at the center of this feature of early modern science. But it's also the century in which the laws of motion, as we know them now, are first articulated. Before the 17th century, people had certainly talked about nature as being governed by overarching laws. But even so, it's only in this century, the 17th century, that specific laws were proposed and their consequences explored. My question then is this. What role did Galileo play in this development? Galileo is well known for having advanced an account of motion that embodies something that looks very much like Newton's principle of inertia, the claim that a body in motion will remain in motion unless otherwise interfered with. And of course, he was also the first to give a mathematical account of the relationship between distance, fallen, and time for a body in free fall. An argument, as well as an argument that a projectile follows a parabolic trajectory. But I'm wondering, do these count as laws of nature? And that's my question. Do these contributions to the theory of motion count as laws of nature for Galileo? One immediate problem with the question itself is, of course, that it would seem to presume that we know what it means to talk about laws of nature. At very least, an answer to that question is not obvious. And recent philosophy of science has struggled with the question for a number of years now. And there are still quite a number of different accounts that are on the table. Rather than approach this as a philosophical question, though, I would like to treat it historically. And I'm going to begin with a brief account of the laws of nature as they were articulated by Descartes, who was a younger contemporary of Galileo's, and actually the first to publish a specific proposal for what it is that the laws of nature are. And after that, I'll turn to Galileo's treatment of bodies in motion, which offers, I think, a very interesting contrast with the Cartesian approach. So I'm going to begin with the question of Descartes and the laws of nature. Now, Descartes may not have invented the idea of a law of nature. The idea that nature is structured in accordance with some general laws that order things in the world. But he may well be the first to actually try to articulate what those laws of nature are in such a way that their consequences for how nature works could be set out, evaluated. For Descartes, of course, body consists in extension alone. Descartes' bodies are the objects of geometry made real. And as a consequence, everything in nature must be explicable in terms of size, shape, and motion of bodies, and the smaller parts that make up bodies. What he calls the rules or laws of nature govern the specific motion of bodies. These laws of nature are first given in chapter 7 of his early treatise, Le Monde, The World. modestly entitled, that was supposed to include everything of importance in the world. They're first articulated there, but Descartes suppressed this treatise in 1633 after Galileo was condemned. So there actually are, we'll see a number of interesting connections between Descartes and Galileo. Excuse me. But the laws appear later in his Principles of Philosophy, suitably rethought and reorganized, which was published in 1644, 2 years after Galileo died. And it is in this form that they were best known by his contemporaries. The laws given in the Principia are as follows. The first law, each and everything, insofar as it can, always continues in the same state, and thus what is once in motion always continues to move. It looks familiar. It is not exactly Newton, but it certainly does look familiar. Law two, all motion is in itself rectilinear. Hence, any body moving in a circle always tends to move away from the center of the circle which it describes. The third law is a law of collision. If a body collides with another body that is stronger than itself, of course, we have to say what it means for one body to be stronger than another. It loses none of its motion, but if it collides with a weaker body, it loses a quantity of motion equal to that which it imparts to the other body. Of course, we also have to know what a quantity of motion is here. This collision law turned out to be monumentally unsuccessful. In fact, a great disaster for the system. But even so, it's interesting, this group of laws was pioneering insofar as it set out what it meant to be a law of nature in great specific detail. Preceding the statement of these laws in the Principia is something that he doesn't call a law, but something that he uses, a principle that he uses extensively in his physics and, in fact, in explicating, for example, the laws of impact. And I'll just read the bold part. In the beginning, God created matter along with its motion and rest, and now merely by his regular concurrence, he preserves the same amount of motion and rest in the material universe as he put there in the beginning. Thus, God imparted various motions to the parts of matter when he first created them, and he now preserves this matter in the same way and by the same process by which he originally created it. It follows from what we have said that this fact alone makes it most reasonable to think that God likewise always preserves the same quantity of motion in matter. And again, the question is, what does quantity of motion mean? And he gives an explication of that. Now, this principle is not called a law, but it's an important constraint on the behavior of bodies in motion. And following the statement of the third law, Descartes works out a series of examples in which he shows the outcome of direct collisions for two bodies with different sizes and speeds. The conservation principle here is the key tool that he uses in deriving these supposed consequences of the third law. And he treats collisions in such a way that the total quantity of motion of the system of colliding bodies remains the same before and after the collision, which is, this is the first statement of a particular conservation law. It turns out not to be right, but it really is, I think, very important, the idea of a conservation law. Now, the argument for the conservation of the quantity of motion is grounded in a theological doctrine, which dates from long before Descartes' time, the view that God must sustain the world from moment to moment for it to continue to exist. Descartes' claim is that because God is immutable and acts in a constant way, the total quantity of motion must remain constant in the world. And this same divine immutability is also what he claims grounds the three explicitly named laws of motion. And I won't read these, but here are a couple of passages where he says the second rule and the first are grounded in divine immutability and divine preservation. And this is what he says about the conservation law. I'm sorry, the collision law. As I said, this was an old theological doctrine, but what's really interesting is the way in which Descartes adapts it to use in a very, very different context from anything that it was originally intended for. It was originally intended to show the, or to reassert that nothing in the world can exist independently of God. But Descartes actually uses it to prove his laws of nature. Now, in what sense are Descartes' laws of nature intended to be laws of nature? Well, first of all, one can point to their generality. They are true not merely of this or that group of particular bodies. It's not just true for earth or fire or celestial bodies, but it's true of all bodies, of bodies as such. Descartes, of course, breaks down the distinction between the celestial and the terrestrial. And for Descartes, all of the so-called Aristotelian elements are basically the same kind of stuff, differentiated just by size, shape, and motion. In both Le Monde and in the later Principia, the principles, the general laws are taken to apply to the cosmos as a whole and are appealed to in a broad and hand-waving way to explain the general features of the cosmos as a whole, such as the fact that there are infinite suns, each of which is a source of light, and so on. Now, in Le Monde, Descartes refers to them as, quote, the laws God imposed on nature. This suggests that the laws are chosen by God and then imposed on bodies. And this is not exactly what it is that's actually going on. Even in Le Monde, which, as in the Principles of Philosophy, grounds the laws in the constant and continuous activity of God on bodies in sustaining them in existence, God does not impose them on bodies in the way in which a monarch might formulate laws and then impose them on citizenry. But there's another sense in which they might be imposed on bodies. For Descartes, bodies are essentially extended and nothing else. And as I understand it, it means that bodies contain only geometrical properties. But as such, considered as the objects of geometry, there's nothing in them that determines that they must obey the rules that Descartes calls laws of nature. Taken by themselves, they're completely indifferent to motion of any kind. However, when they're realized in nature as real existent things, they must behave in a certain way because of the way in which an immutable God sustains them. What Descartes calls the laws of nature is really just a way of formulating how it is that God keeps them in existence. And I should note here that even when created and sustained by God, they are still, in a way, indifferent from motion. They have no innate tendency to move in one way rather than in another. And in particular, they have no tendency to move up or down. Gravitation, heaviness, is a force that has got to be imposed on them from the outside. But insofar as these laws don't follow from the nature of body as such, and insofar as they require God's intervention, we might say that they are indeed imposed on body by God. This can be so even though Descartes claims that, quote, if God had created many worlds, these laws would be as true in those worlds as they are in this one. To that extent, one might want to say that the laws of nature are, in some sense, necessary for Descartes. But if they're necessary, it's not because of any necessity in body or any necessity in the laws themselves, but only because God exists necessarily and is necessarily immutable. So he will necessarily act immutably in any possible world that he creates. In this way, the laws of nature pertain not to the essence of body as such, but to its continued existence, as the continued existence derives directly from God. Now, it's interesting to note here that as Descartes understands them, the laws of nature by themselves do not entail that bodies are heavy, as I suggested. That is, that they tend to fall toward the center of the earth. Cartesian bodies are completely indifferent to motion, as I noted earlier, including gravitational motion. And so for Descartes, bodies tend to fall to the center of the earth only because of the particular configuration of the vortex of subtle matter that surrounds the Earth and the makeup of the gross bodies of our experience. And I'll come back to that when we talk about Galileo in just a moment. So much for Descartes and his laws of nature. And at this point, I'd finally like to turn to Galileo, our main character, and to his treatment of motion. Now, there's no doubt that in some sense, Galileo did recognize the idea of laws of nature. In his important letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, where he discusses Copernicanism in the Bible, he wrote, "Nature is inexorable and immutable. She never transgresses the laws, legi, imposed upon her, or cares a whit whether her abstruse reasons and methods of operation or are understandable to men." Even though in a very general sense, Galileo may have recognized the importance of the laws of nature, can we regard the specific claims that he makes about the behavior of bodies in motion as instances of these laws? Now, Galileo worried about the behavior of bodies in motion for virtually his entire career. From the time he was a young professor until his last years under house arrest, it would not be appropriate in this modest essay to try to survey Galileo's thought throughout his long career. But instead, I'd like to begin by looking at the treatment of bodies in motion in his last work, The Two New Sciences. And I will say that my view of Galileo's career is this is what he was really interested in from the beginning. He got sort of diverted by the telescope and by the fame that came from the telescope, and is probably better known today for his Copernicanism than for his theory of motion in the popular world. But I think it was the theory of motion that really interested him from the beginning. Now, going back to The Two New Sciences, published in 1638 while Galileo was in under house arrest. The second of the two new sciences in this work is the science of motion. It's introduced at the beginning of the third day of the dialogue, where the interlocutors gather to read and discuss a Latin treatise by a person that they call the academician, which is, of course, Galileo. The treatise, which is a text from earlier, much earlier in Galileo's career, which is probably the results of work on motion that were done in the first decade of the 17th century before the telescopic stuff. And this begins as follows. "We bring forward a brand new science concerning a very old subject. There's perhaps nothing older in nature than motion, about which volumes neither few nor small have been written by philosophers. Yet I find many essentials of it that are worth knowing, which have not even been remarked, let alone demonstrated." And this then is the subject matter of the new science. It's going to be motion. And it's going to be what he treats then in the third and fourth days of the dialogue. In the third day, Galileo begins with a treatment of uniform motion. The centerpiece is the treatment of naturally accelerated motion. For most readers, the featured result is the often referred to law of free fall. Galileo himself doesn't call it a law. And this is Proposition 2, Theorem 2. A movable descends from rest in uniformly accelerated motion. The spaces run through in any times whatever are to each other, as the duplicate ratio of their times, that is, they are as the squares of those times. And so according to this theorem, the distance fallen by a body in free fall is proportional to the square of the time. Also important is the so-called odd number rule, a corollary to this theorem, in accordance with which the distances fallen in equal successive times are proportional to the sequence of odd numbers. Interestingly, though, Galileo's own presentation is somewhat different and not focused on the Times Square law. He begins with a question as to what the proper definition of accelerated motion is, and the definition that he proposes is the following. I say that motion is equably or uniformly accelerated, which abandoning rests, adds onto itself equal momenta of swiftness in equal times. But Galileo wonders, is this definition the correct definition for falling bodies as they actually occur in nature? And so in this passage he asks, okay, what is, this is a definition of acceleration, but does this definition actually fit what it is that happens in nature? We can think up all sorts of complicated laws of acceleration. This is a nice simple one, but is this what actually happens in nature? So this is the project, and this then is the question that that he investigates. The theorem, generally called the law of free fall, is presented as a direct mathematical consequence of this definition. Galileo then goes on to investigate nature and to see if falling bodies actually satisfy that consequence. That is, he goes to nature to see if the distance fallen is proportional to the square of the time. Actually, it's a bit more complicated than that. Galileo doesn't have the means to actually measure that directly, so he has to slow free fall down by rolling balls down inclined planes so that he can actually measure the time and compare it to the distance fallen. But then he needs to establish that the relationship between time and distance fallen and free fall will be the same for a ball rolling down an inclined plane. So it actually turns out to be fairly complicated. And in addition to that, it turns out to be complicated even to measure time, because the sorts of devices that they had for measuring time were not capable of measuring, say, seconds and things like that. So he has to invent a water clock to be able to measure that. It turns out to be rather complicated, and there's every reason to believe that he actually did these experiments to show that the distance fallen is proportional to the time square. And so his conclusion is that the definition of acceleration that he begins with, the discussion, quote, this first and chief foundation upon which rests an immense framework of infinitely many conclusions, is indeed the kind of acceleration that's at issue when we're dealing with falling bodies in nature. Now, the remaining pages of the third day of the dialogue, I'm going to come back to this, of course, and ask, is this a law of nature? But in the remaining pages of the third day of the dialogue, Galileo goes on to draw further consequences from the definition of natural acceleration that he establishes earlier on in the dialogue. And among the consequences that Galileo noted was one that we may consider of special interest. In the middle of the scolium to proposition 23, problem 9, remember that, it's going to be on the test, Galileo makes the following observation. It may also be noted that whatever degree of speed is found in the movable, that is, by its nature indelibly impressed on it when external causes of acceleration or retardation are removed, which occurs only on the horizontal plane. For on declining planes there is cause of more acceleration, and on rising planes, retardation. From this it follows that that motion in the horizontal is also eternal, since if it is indeed equable, it is not weakened or remitted, much less removed. So the idea is when you have a ball rolling down an inclined plane, it will accelerate. When it goes up an inclined plane, it will decelerate. So what's going to happen on a perfectly horizontal plane? Well, it's going to neither accelerate nor decelerate. It will be eternal. And this, of course, looks very much like Descartes' first and second laws of nature from the principles, the so-called, but I think incorrectly called, principle of inertia. but there are crucial differences. It's important to note here that what Galileo is talking about is not rectilinear motion, but horizontal motion, the motion on a plane, all of whose points remain equidistant from some point toward which a heavy body is attracted. And sort of locally, for small distances, it will look very much like a straight line, a straight plane. But of course, if you go far enough, it will eventually curve all the way around the Earth. And that's the kind of eternal motion that Galileo is talking about. So what persists is circular motion around a point to which a heavy body tends to fall. And it's important to note that we are dealing with motion on a plane. If the plane were eliminated, then the body would simply continue to fall toward the center of attraction. You know, you come to the end of the plane and it'll just continue to fall. And finally, it should be noted that as salient as this observation is to us, in the context of the third day of the Discorsi, Galileo presents this as simply an observation in passing in the course of a scholium. In the context of the third day, it doesn't even get a separate designation as a theorem or proposition, though we may consider it of special importance and special interest. In the context of this dialogue, Galileo doesn't seem to. Now, this observation has a special role to play in the central proposition of the fourth day. The very first proposition of the fourth day is Galileo's account of projectile motion. When a projectile is carried in motion, is carried in motion compounded from the equable horizontal and from naturally accelerated downward motion, it describes a semi-parabolic line in its movement. So imagine now the heavy body rolling along on a horizontal plane and the plane ends. It will continue in this direction horizontally, he'll say, but in uniform motion, but in this direction in accelerated motion. And this proposition is proved quite simply by putting together the uniform motion of a body on a horizontal plane with the accelerated motion of a body in free fall. And when you combine the two, it follows straightforwardly that a projectile describes a semi-parabola. Now, in this way, Galileo's new theory of motion is able to give a very sophisticated mathematical treatment of the motion of bodies in various important circumstances, in free fall, on a horizontal plane, in projectile motion. And these were really, really important to Galileo's contemporaries, really striking conclusions. But are these laws? Are these laws of nature? In framing this question, I'm implicitly, at least, drawing a comparison between Galileo's program and that of Descartes. Now, while Descartes knew Galileo's work on motion, the Principles was published 2 years after Galileo died, and we know Descartes read the two new sciences. We have Descartes' reading notes on the two new sciences. But of course, Galileo did not know Descartes, did not know Descartes' Principles, which were published after his death. Descartes left a long letter commenting on Galileo's Discorsi, but Descartes' Principles only came out after Galileo's death. But even so, it's interesting, and I think not anachronistic, to look at the ways in which Galileo's approach to the study of bodies and motion may be different in important respects from that of Descartes. As near contemporaries, the ways in which their projects diverge is, I think, revealing for both of them, and particularly about what laws of nature mean for people at this point. The facts about motion that we have been examining depend strongly on the assumption that we're dealing with heavy bodies, bodies that have a tendency to fall toward a particular point. In the two new sciences, that point is, of course, the center of the Earth, which he assumes. In his earlier book, The Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, the book that got him into trouble, that got him condemned in 1632, there Galileo attempts to generalize this. I mean, it may seem out of order, but as a matter of fact, the results on the theory of motion precede the two great world systems by a long time. And so he makes an application of them before he actually publishes his statement of them in 1638. excuse me. But in any case, Galileo attempts to generalize this. In the first day of that dialogue, he attempts to articulate an alternative to the Aristotelian cosmology, which takes the center of the Earth as the center of the universe. And in that context, he writes, "Everybody constituted in a state of rest but naturally capable of motion will move when set at liberty only if it has a natural tendency toward some particular place. For if it were indifferent to all places, it would remain at rest, having no more cause to move one way than another. Having such a tendency, it naturally follows that in its motion it will continually be accelerated." Obvious contrast with Descartes, who really does think that bodies as such don't have any tendency to go one place rather than another. Galileo is working in a context in which he's dealing with bodies that do. And it's evident that the center of the Earth is at least one particular place for bodies on the Earth. But he's attempting to that now generalize this. But this is what he says about the Earth. "Parts of the Earth do not move so as to go toward the center of the universe, but so as to unite with a whole Earth, and that consequently they have a natural tendency toward the center of the terrestrial globe, by which tendency they cooperate to form and preserve it." But it's not at all clear how to generalize this to bodies outside of the Earth. In the two great world systems, Galileo does offer his famous Platonic hypothesis about the formation of the planetary system. And this is an attempt now, I think, to generalize this. "Let us suppose that among the decrees of the divine architect was the thought of creating in the universe those globes which we behold continually revolving, and of establishing a center of their rotations in which the sun was located immovably. Next, suppose all the said globes to have been created in the same place, and there assigned tendencies of motion descending toward the center," which of course he thinks is the sun, "until they had acquired those degrees of velocity which originally seemed good to the divine mind. These velocities being acquired, we lastly suppose the globes were set in rotation, each retaining in its orbit its predetermined velocity." So the idea is, it's sort of like marbles. There is the center out here, the sun. God is out there. He's created all the planets and sort of lets them roll one by one. And when they accelerating toward the center, the sun, and when they reach the appropriate velocity, he then veers them off into an orbit. And this is a kind of hypothesis about how it is that the universe was formed. Galileo claims that if we assume such a hypothesis, we can find a single place from which, should each of the planets be imagined to fall toward the sun, and their final speed converted into rotational motion, we would get a system that agrees very closely with the perceived, the observed speeds of the actual planets. He was wrong, by the way. It's a nice conjecture, and it's a beautiful image, but it really just doesn't work. But in this way, Galileo hypothesizes the sun as a center of tendency for the planets, and in this way, in principle, extends his account of the motion of the planet, his account of motion that we find later published in the Two New Sciences, to the planets with respect to the sun. But this is really far from a systematic generalization of the accounts of free fall, the persistence of horizontal motion, and the behavior of projectiles, which remain particular claims about heavy bodies near the center of the Earth. What would happen, for example, if a piece of Earth were released 10 feet over the surface of Mars, or a Martian rock 10 feet over the surface of the Earth? And what happens to bodies in interplanetary space beyond the orbit of the last planet? Or, for that matter, in between the orbits of the planets as they actually have? Galileo has given us a story about what it is that happens on Earth. He's given us a hypothesis about how it is that the cosmos is formed. But there's still a lot of details in between. Galileo's version of the inertial principle is also strongly dependent upon the tendency that heavy bodies have to fall toward a center. His argument is that for such bodies, they will accelerate when approaching the center of attraction and decelerate when going away from such a center. And as a consequence, when neither accelerating or receding from such a center, they will neither accelerate or decelerate, but move at a constant speed on a surface that remains at a constant distance from the center. This is his sort of inertial principle. This is an interesting and important property of motion, but again, one that depends strongly on the fact that we're dealing with heavy bodies, that is, bodies near the surface of the Earth. It tells us nothing, for example, about the behavior of a chunk of Earth on the surface of Mars. We don't know how that's going to. There's nothing in Galileo's argument that tells us how it is that that's going to work. Lacking an obvious general applicability outside of a fairly narrow context, it's difficult to see how Galileo's accounts of motion could play anything like the role in organizing the Galilean world that Descartes' laws of nature play in his, where they're used to explain the structure of the whole universe. In writing to Mersenne about his impressions of Galileo's Discorsi, the Two New Sciences, Descartes wrote the following. It's rather arrogant, but still kind of interesting and revealing. Generally speaking, I find that he philosophizes much more ably than usual. In that, so far as he can, he abandons the errors of the schools and tries to use mathematical methods in the investigation of physical questions. On that score, I'm completely one with him. But he continually digresses, and he does not take time to explain matters fully. This, in my view, is a mistake. It shows that he has not investigated matters in an orderly way, and he has merely sought out explanations for some particular effects without going into the primary causes of nature, and hence his building lacks a foundation. Now, it seems true to say that Galileo's building lacks a foundation. The generalizations that Galileo presents explain things on Earth, but they fail to treat nature as a whole. For that, he would need to articulate general laws that unite the treatment of terrestrial and the cosmological domains. Now, this may not be entirely fair to Galileo. It isn't clear to me that he wanted to do the kind of thing that Descartes was doing, and may have been quite happy to work piecemeal, one problem at a time. Which is to say, his was a different scientific program, one in which the laws of nature, at least in the sense in which Descartes recognized them, play no substantive role. In a letter that Galileo wrote to Belisario Vinta in 1610, describing the project that would, some many years later, become days 3 and 4 of the Discorsi, Galileo wrote, I plan 3 books on locomotion, all an entirely new science in which no one else, ancient or modern, has discovered any of the most remarkable characteristics. And the word he uses there is symptomi, which I demonstrate to exist in both natural and violent motion. And similarly, in a letter from January 1639, shortly after the publication of the Two New Sciences in 1638, Galileo describes the project in similar terms. I'm interested in examining what might be the characteristics, the symptomi, which accompany the motion of a moving body, which starting from a state of rest, it goes on moving with a speed that constantly increases in the same way. And he consistently uses this word syntomi, which is probably more literally translated as symptom, but in this context means characteristic. He definitely does not use the word law. He knows about laws. You remember the quotation I gave at the beginning from the letter to the Grand Duchess Christina. He knows, he has the idea of laws. He doesn't see himself as doing that. Galileo has the concept of an overarching law of nature, something that governs reality as a whole, but his mathematical account of motions is more modest, never conceived in those terms. His aim is just to give some of the most interesting syntomi, characteristics, of accelerated motion. Since the time of Descartes, the idea of a law of nature has become established as one of the fundamental notions in our conception of nature. Since Descartes' day, of course, the idea of a law of nature has changed considerably. We may no longer agree that the world is governed by laws of nature in precisely the sense in which Descartes understood them. But in Galileo, we have what may be a different kind of project altogether, a thoroughly systematic and even mathematical account of at least some aspects of the motion of bodies, but without the idea of a law of nature. Thank you for your attention.